Welcome to Nothing of Champagne, a podcast you can't judge by headlines alone. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
So, friend of the podcast and one of our celebrity listeners, maybe the first and original celebrity listener, Mark Pack, has written a book. It's called Bad News, What the Headlines Don't Tell You. And he kindly sent us a review copy, so we're going to talk about it. So we're going to have a review of the book up on the Not Enough Champagne website once I've written it. I think so. Hopefully that'll be up in the next week or so. I've read the book in its entirety, Steve. I would have passed it to you to read it, except none of us can leave the house at the moment.
Yeah, the lockdown has prevented us from passing on the book, unfortunately.
What we've done for this podcast is just picked out three or four key bits that we're going to have, I think, talk about in a little bit more depth. Basically, what the book is a guide to how the news works and to help readers consume the news around them, I suppose. There's a kind of three different sort of bits that it's about. So one of them is a sort of, if anyone read Nick Davis's Flat Earth News, kind of talking about journalism and what stories get covered and why, how news features by geographically. So some stories which are focused on London and America get more coverage because that's where journalists are, that kind of stuff. There's lots of stuff about statistics as well, and numbers that are used in the news. In a Daryl Huff wrote a book a few years ago called How to Lie with Statistics. And a lot of the stuff that Mark writes about is quite similar to stuff in that book as well. And then the other bit, which we're going to have more of a talk about in this podcast, is a talk about political news, particularly political polls, election campaigns, looking at how they are covered. I found probably the most interesting part of the book, actually. And it is a very well-written book, as you'd expect. If you've read Mark's website, you'll know he's able to write and joke. The footnotes, even. I don't know if you got this in the bits that you've seen, Steve, but the footnotes even are quite entertaining.
Yeah, there were a couple of quite witty footnotes in the bits that, I have seen as part of the preparation for this. There's almost something quite, I don't know, Pratchett-esque, like Terry Pratchett, and the way he did his kind of like footnotes. That's generally what it reminded me of.
I like the footnotes, but not got on the paperback front cover, but Pratchett-esque might. I might confuse a lot of people, assuming that we're going to get some sort of fantasy world, Discworld style book, and then it's about Lib Dems.
To be fair, given the Lib Dems I know, most of them would probably be are massive fantasy nerds and love Pratchett, so they'd probably be one of the few groups that would be happy with that.
This is true. What we're going to talk about first, so as I say, the big, probably about the first 1800 pages of the book is essentially how to unpick different news stories. So by looking at, say, the headline, looking at the sources, looking at who's quoted, looking at who's not quoted, looking at punctuation in the headline, for instance. So if there's quote marks in the headline, usually a sign of a very, very misleading story.
Likewise, the other thing is if there's a question mark, then likelihood that the answer isn't to that question is no.
Basically, punctuation in news stories, generally good, shows they can write. Punctuation in headlines, not good. So we talked about the fact it's a sort of flat earth news style kind of look at the kind of stories that get covered and how they get covered and why they get covered in that way. And I suppose one of the themes that runs through the book is the fact that truth moves too slowly for the news.
I mean, there is that kind of old saying that you know, a lie travels halfway around the world before the truth has even got its shoes on, which I don't know if that is a widespread saying or if it's just something that my parents and grandparents said, but
no, it's a Graham Parker song as well, so I think it is a known idiom.
Okay, excellent. But yeah, so the notion that you know, the truth takes a while to get out is nothing new. But I think certainly in relation to the headlines and the news, especially the modern day news, it's definitely become more of an issue. Because we live in an age of constant deadlines where, you know, you need to get something out either online or to print or tweeted out or shared on Facebook or something for a video that's going to be going up on YouTube. There's always a pressing deadline, which means there's always a need for more content. And as a result of that, the media as a whole, this isn't just limited to just like the print media, the media as a whole are just going, right, I need a story, give me a story. Which means when something comes along and it's got a nice element in it, which can be turned into in a fact, and it can be turned into an angle or spun in a certain way, they go, great, we need to write up a story on this particular part of this wider story and make that the focus of the headline or whatever, because that's what's going to grab people's attention. And when people see that, they don't necessarily engage with the whole story with the whole story, or they don't read the entire piece, or they don't watch the entire video. They just kind of blindly follow or kind of assume that it's true and then retweet it, share it, whatever, and then it just kind of goes out into the world. And even within the articles themselves, they can be contradictory to the headline. So you end up in this very odd situation where the media is propagating, in effect, inaccuracies, if you want to be nice, or outright lying, if you want to be a bit more harsh, or in the name of just getting content so they can get clicks so they can make money, whilst actually the stories themselves are just saying something completely different.
Because of the nature of checking for facts, and because of the wider nature of the collection of scientific evidence and the collection of proof, it doesn't really lend itself to checking stories. I mean, there's a couple of examples he gives, and actually one of them I thought was really interesting because I didn't even realize the story itself had been retracted. So 2003, Mark talks about the reports of looting from Baghdad's National Museum of Iraq. And the reports at the time, which were sourced, well-sourced, they talked about the theft of 170,000 objects. But actually, the real number that was looted was less than a tenth of that. So it was just under 14,000.
And of those artifacts that were taken, most of them weren't even necessarily looted. There were three specific incidents, only one of which was a looting. So even like the process behind the loss was inaccurate as well.
Okay, the truth came out, but it was 2 years afterwards. And as you say, it's the truth came, you know, 2 years afterwards. But after all, that lie has gone all the way around the world. And I didn't realise until reading the book, actually, that any sort of retraction from that story had come out. The one in terms of scientific evidence, and I suppose particularly the media, the fact that a lot of journalists maybe aren't very science savvy and have problems reporting science, and certainly problems of trying to ascertain truth with science, are the stuff about Andrew Wakefield and the MMR vaccine.
Andrew Wakefield and his vaccine study on MMR is a very good example of kind of like the real world impacts that these kind of like, well, basically the failure to understand or the failure to check stories properly, what that actually can have in terms of real world consequences. Because the anti-vax movement exists largely today in the form it does because of Andrew Wakefield. You know, we have seen as a result of this, you know, diseases that were once basically wiped out, like measles and chickenpox and things like that, coming back in various parts of the US, and where there's been a mass drop off in people getting vaccinations because people are concerned about the impacts that the vaccination will have, even though there is absolutely zero scientific evidence to support that worry.
One of the things that kind of goes to the book is Mark Pack talking about how actually he's reading fewer and fewer daily newspapers. There are very, very few people now, I suppose, watch the news regularly at 6 or watch the news regularly at 10, part of their regular routine. What instead people tend to do is tune in when there is a big story. So I think when Boris Johnson on Monday was announced the lockdown of the UK, I think 27 million people watched it. But that doesn't happen for news all the time. And so what in Mark Pack's view anyway, what the news needs to do to counteract that, what they've been doing is becoming more sensationalist to try and cut through. And you can see that headlines in particular, if we go to that bit. So there's an interesting story it talks about from The Guardian. Actually, another good thing, another really interesting thing about the book is, obviously it talks a lot about the issues in the media and the issues with facts in reporting stories. It doesn't just use the red tops and the tabloids. You'll find as many examples from The Guardian in the book as you will do from the Daily Mail, which I found particularly interesting. Like, it does kind of get you out of that filter bubble. An example Pat uses from The Guardian is outcry as residents want to turn London Youth Club into a coffee shop is the headline. Except then if you go further into the article, but actually residents wanted to repurpose the space as maybe a tumble dryer facility for residents, a private library and internet facility, or a coffee shop. Outcry as residents want to turn London Youth Club into a library isn't a very eye-catching story. And so what The Guardian has done in that headline is they've chosen the most sensationalist version to broadcast, when actually you could write a very different version of that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and essentially what a lot of this boils down to is that an awful lot of the media is in a very difficult position financially. People's consumption habits are changing drastically, and they're desperately trying to not even gain a new audience, but maintain the audience that they already have. And as a result of this, they've ended up almost making Hail Mary passes of these kind of like sensationalist headlines to try and grab people's attention, because we exist in a world where the attention of the audience is a limited commodity. We only have so much of it to give at any point in time. And as a result of that, you know, they're constantly trying to drag us back in in effect, you know, yelling at us on social media to kind of look at this drastic sensationalist thing that's happening, look how terrible this is, and we're more likely to engage with those than we are with, actually, as much as we like to share wholesome pictures of cats and puppies online, you know, we're not going to click on The Guardian for that, are we? You know, we're just going to go to that one specific Twitter feed or that one Reddit forum. You know, feel good stories don't sell papers. Disasters and catastrophes do.
There's a couple of things I think on that. So one of them is that I think one of the reasons why I think Mark's written the book is to try and make us more an active consumer of news rather than a passive consumer of news. So rather than just sitting at our screens and blindly sharing anything on social media or a social media story, or you read the headline on the Guardian website, whatever, and you share it out, try and make people outraged or to share your view. It's more about being able to go behind the headlines, being able to unpack maybe different parts of the story. It's meant to be almost a guide for you to be the detective to work out things. But I think the interesting thing, actually, in terms of headlines, and the reason I think I wanted to focus on headlines in this discussion, is it's not really something that Mark Pack talks about. But so what he mentions is that obviously the headline of a news story is almost always going to be the most misleading part of the article. But that makes me think about the way in which actually we've started to consume news stories, especially from other news sources online. And that tends to be exclusively through the headlines, which are put on screenshots on Twitter and then shared on Twitter or WhatsApp, sometimes Facebook. It used to be that idea of clickbait. So, you know, the Daily Mail would have a deliberately provocative article that everyone would click on and get outraged by, except people don't tend to click on it anymore. So the website doesn't necessarily earn those ad revenue for the amount of clicks it gets. Instead, what people tend to do is get from, say, the Mail or the Times or the Telegraph, they'll screenshot the headline and then share that on social media. I think especially now there's a paywall as well on the Times and Telegraph articles. You don't actually have the ability to read that whole article. And so it means it's actually maybe harder for people to get out the filter bubble. But also it means the only way you see those articles or consume those articles is with the headline, which is the most misleading bit. So it ends up almost confirming people in their filter bubbles rather than helping people get out of their filter bubbles.
From some work I did back at my old job for one of my old clients, we were looking at kind of like how people actually engaged with social media and news stories and things like that that came across their news feeds. The reality is the vast majority of things that we share online, we don't actually read or engage with properly in any way. You'll probably find different studies which give you kind of like slightly different percentage, but broadly speaking, it's the same kind of rough amount. So the stat I found was that 59% of things that we share online, we don't actually read. We just go, oh, hey, this effectively confirms my pre-existing biases or something I'm really interested in. Am I going to retweet that? Am I going to share that? And which will then go out to my followers, who are largely going to be, in all likelihood, very similar to myself. So you're right in that it definitely reinforces those filters, those bubbles that we've created online, especially when, you know, as you say, we can't access the actual article for a lot of these places anymore. So we've got to go off of is the headline, which is designed to be sensational and may not necessarily reflect the actual article's main point.
But I think the best bits of the book are the more political bits on things like opinion polls. So there's a 20-page chapter on polls, which I think the government should put into a little pamphlet and post through the door of anyone who is thinking about commenting on polls on Twitter. Because, yeah, again, a lot of it is things that we've sort of talked about on the podcast already. And if you follow websites like UK Polling Report, or you look at the sort of stuff that Matt Singh might do and Number Crunch Politics or John Curtis, what have you, that a lot of the talk of, say, margins of error, or is it an outlier poll or is it a trend? These are things that we've talked about. But I think Mark does a really, really good job in defending polls, talking about the issues with news coverage of them, and dispelling a lot of the myths that you'll see whenever a poll comes up in a good 20 pages. And just one example that I really liked is, and you always, without fail, see this when a poll comes up, which is, oh, well, I'm never asked by an opinion pollster. No, I've never been asked by one. So who are these people that they're asking? And bless him, Mark actually does the maths. So
yeah, I really like that.
So a poll will survey 1,000 people, and there are 23 companies in the trade body, apparently, according to the British Polling Council. But let's just assume there's 30 companies. So if 30 companies are doing a survey every week, that's 1,500 surveys in a year. Now, that means even if every single person whose poll is different, that's 1.5 million people a year. With an adult population of 40 million, that puts your chances at less than 1 in 20. But in practice, it's lower than that because some people are asked to join in more than once.
In practice, you have probably about a 3-4%, if not lower, chance of participating in any given poll at any point. Like, there's not a massive chance that you are actually going to be asked to participate unless you're a part of something like YouGov, where it's online surveys where you have to opt into it.
Yeah, exactly. And even like just the way that it explains margins of error, as someone who's not really trained in statistics, I found really, really helpful. And honestly, it makes the stuff on polls, I think, is it makes the book, it's worth the price of the book on its own, actually. Just to get your head around the issue of polling, but also to next time you end up in a online argument about X poll says Y, which actually we're seeing quite a bit at the moment anyway, because not to, you know, venture into the thorny field of current events, but there was a poll out yesterday, I believe, that put the Tories on about 54% and Labour on about 25%. And even though actually the thing that there is no point really in looking at polls at the moment, because this is no normal political situation. Instead, you have the usual guff that is mentioned about polls, all polls are Tory, or and I'm never asked a poll, and what can a poll that's only got 1,000 people in tell you, all that kind of nonsense. And actually, Mark has done a very, very nice calm demolition of all that kind of nonsense, which is really worth reading. The thing I think which is interesting as well is what it talks about, the the coverage of opinion polls. And again, it's another little bit of a theme that runs through the book, which is news coverage, which looks at politics in particular through the kind of angle of the horse race. So, you know, who's up, who's down, is that vote going to pass? But doesn't actually look at the underlying issue behind the policy or behind the thing that's going to get voted on. It's just looked at in terms of, is it going to pass or not? Or who's up and who's down?
Yeah, absolutely. And fundamentally, that goes back to like the what we were talking about earlier about the sensationalism of journalism, because drama sells. Drama is what people are kind of like actually interested in. Like the actual technical guff and things like for politics, for science, for welfare, anything really, people are going to find very dry, and largely speaking, unless you're actually really interested in it, quite boring. You know, I try and stay pretty well read on various issues, but you know, even I end up kind of looking at some things on to do with certain aspects of social policy or science and go or whatever, and I go, you know what, I just can't bring myself to actually read this or understand this properly, just because it's not something I'm actually particularly interested in. But if you put it into a dramatic perspective and attach a narrative to it and attach stakes to it, well, suddenly that's something that everybody can understand. That's something that everybody can engage with. So from the perspective of policy and I suppose elections as well, you know, that kind of that who's up, who's down narrative is just much more engaging, because it's something everybody can latch onto and can understand.
But I take slight issue with that, because I think it's easier to write about, because you just need to have someone who's sat in Westminster writing about it. Whereas actually you could... It would take a bit more research, but actually you probably could write a very readable article with narrative hooks and fancy graphics about issues of social policy. It's just that would take longer and therefore isn't written about.
You absolutely can write a readable article about pretty much anything if you do take the time to it. But one, having the time in this age of needing constant content that's quicker and easy to churn out, as we've kind of discussed already, is a separate issue. But it's also the fact that even if you did produce a really good readable article on a complex issue, the reality is the people who are reading it are going to be you and me and people like Mark, not necessarily the people who are buying The Sun.
Even if it was just a base level of, okay, and I think this is a point that Mark makes in the book actually, is rather than it be about, you know, the horse race of who's up and who's down, it could be, okay, what issues do you care about? Is it education? Is it social policy? What are the politicians saying about that issue? But that's not necessarily even what is written about in the news. Or actually, if we use this to come on to the final thing we're going to talk about, it's not even really what is talked about in terms of election campaign coverage either. And again, another really good section of the book is when Mark talks about the flaws in election campaign coverage as he sees it. Partly it's the runners and riders thing we've talked about, but it's also this idea of the media going over the top about amazing new campaign techniques like collecting email lists or using data to look at and analyse the behaviour of various voters, which Mark, I suppose, literally wrote the book on winning elections, but seems to think is a little bit overblown.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff on kind of like the election campaigns was something I found quite interesting from the bits that I've been able to obviously read so far. Because there is definitely, and I'm coming from this as a perspective of somebody who works in like digital marketing and digital media, there is definitely a lack of understanding within the media of digital kind of like marketing techniques and kind of like the impact they have on people, and that as a result of that, the impact they might have on an election. And there's definitely a level of kind of like illiteracy in a number of areas about the more modern tactics, I suppose, and strategies of electoral campaigning. So it would not surprise me if basically from the ground up there was just a lack of understanding about what campaigning actually is, what it's meant to achieve, you know, what we should be kind of like focusing on from a kind of like a media perspective.
But so I mean, one of the things it talks about is Barack Obama's email list, and one of the amount, the plethora of articles that came out about the amazingness of the Obama email list, when actually, you know, if you were to unpick it, how many of those email addresses are correct? I mean, I've certainly been in the position of wanting to collect emails for an email list for an organization I'm part of, and then you know, get the names that people have written down at the end of the night. I think, I can't read any of these names to put them into the sheet. And so you've got issues of transcription. You've got issues of, actually, there might be people in the UK who are part of Obama's American mailing list who can't vote. And the other example is the 2015 election as well. Emphasis and lots of articles were put on the campaign team having lots of data to analyze of various voters, whereas actually the academic studies produced about the campaign afterwards, they found it, actually the reason the Tories won in 2015 was national swing plus an incumbency advantage in some of the areas they had in 2010.
I mean, certainly for the from the British kind of like perspective, there's kind of raised questions around, like, not just in terms of the media's kind of belief in, like, the importance of campaigns and certain campaigning tactics, but for political parties as well, who kind of, I think, get swept up in the narratives that the media actually create in and of themselves when they discuss these things, because, you know, so much of the talk was, you know, has been of, you know, the role of Cambridge Analytica and that kind of paid social media and things like that in the Brexit referendum and like the Tory campaigns and for the general elections. And the reality is, it's probably not actually made a massive difference in any massive way, maybe in some areas in a small way, but it's on its own, it doesn't shift anything. It's a small cog in a wider campaign, which is just, you know, of which the victorious side was better than the losing side.
To come back to a point you made earlier, it's about this need for a narrative, isn't it? The idea of a kind of national swing can be quite an abstract concept, whereas if you can say, it's because of this, and you kind of give it a name, especially if it's a shadowy name that sounds like a kind of a company that's run by a Bond villain.
In my head, I kind of like a misremembering of sorts of a quote, again from Terry Pratchett, actually, going back to what we were talking about earlier.
The Mark Pack of science fiction writing.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a kind of a quote from one of the, I think it's the second Science of the Discworld book, where he basically says, anthropologists got it wrong when they named our species Homo sapiens, wise man. It's an arrogant and big-headed thing to say, wisdom being one of our least evident features, but in reality, we are Pans Narang, the storytelling chimpanzee. You know, man is more interested in stories than they are in wisdom and fact and truth. We engage with stories a hell of a lot more. So, yeah, sorry. Just thought that was, there's a nice little kind of thing to throw in there.
I would say it's available from all good bookshops, but you can't go to any. So buy it from bookshops online instead. It's published by Biteback. I assume you can get it through their website, Waterstones and Foils, or a nice independent bookshop if you've got anyone near you that's ordering stuff online. Hello, Mark, if you're listening. You did say on Facebook you'd come and talk about the book. So it'd be interesting actually to try and talk about bad news and the coronavirus, I think, would be an interesting if you fancy coming on. Right. If you wanted to give us some money so that we could write some misleading stories, you could go to our Patreon page, couldn't you, Steve?
You could indeed, although obviously our stories would not be misleading, for we are better than that.
We're all inherently infallible, Steve.
But yeah, you can head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/notenoughchampagne. You can throw us a couple of quid. That money goes towards paying for our costs, you know, hosting for the website, hosting for the podcast feed. Head over there. You can, if you do sign up, you can get access to exclusive episodes, exclusive content, such as articles, early access to bits and pieces as well. So take a look and let us know if you fancy becoming our patrons.
We also have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed the logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Pretty Good Times. We'll probably be out in the week if you want to hear that episode in the week, you're going to have to subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. My Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
Mine's @acousticradical.
Happy plotting.